This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents World of Warcraft, Shadows Rising by Madeline Rue. Read for you by Susan Wacoma. For my brothers, who built my first computer, introducing me to the wonder of video games, and for all the devs, writers, artists, and players who love Azeroth, this one is for you. Prologue. Westfall. Anduin Rin rode as if 1,000 screaming servants of the void followed close at his back, thunder booming above in the sky and crashing below as his horse's hooves beat the ground hard, carrying him across the wounded plains of Westfall. No one but his loyal friend and spymaster chased him, but it didn't matter. Darkness nipped at his heels, and he would do whatever he could to outrun it. At least for the moment. At least for one moment. Sire! Sire! Damn you, my horse is going to throw a shoe! Matthias Shaw's voice managed to rise above the rumbling overhead and din of the horses. Anduin ignored him, clucking his tongue, spurring reverence faster. Faster! 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 He couldn't slow down. Not for anything. In the distance, a tower of debris and energy rose like a crystalline spike from the low hills of the farmlands. He couldn't take his eyes away from it as the thickening clouds above rolled closer, casting a shadow over the land. He remembered thinking it impossible that Westfall could change so drastically. But the cataclysm had raged, heedless of a young man's nostalgia. And yet, it was as if his own childhood, his own deeply held memories had been rearranged. He was but a boy then, untested. Now he felt honed as a blade. That untested boy had thought certain things remained constant, but now he knew such beliefs to be childish. Nothing was permanent. Any city could crumble, but foes could also become allies. Even friends. There was no more wisdom in cynicism than in optimism. Sire! He relented at last, pulling gently on Reverence's reins, the magnificent white horse slowing to a canter, allowing the spymaster to gain ground and trot up to his side. My apologies, Anduin sighed, tossing back the hair that had fallen into his eyes. That must have been a taxing ride for your old bones. You didn't tell me this was a race, Shaw grunted. Despite Anduin's teasing, the older man, weathered but still strong and cunning, wasn't even out of breath.
With fair warning, I would leave you crying in the dust, Your Majesty.
Well, Anduin reined his horse around to face the wall of forest behind them, across the river in Elwyn.
We shall have to put that to the test. Maybe, but you're first going to tell me why you're riding like a madman today. The last thing we need is you getting thrown and snapping your royal neck.
Shaw had a rough way about him, and his voice was equally gruff, as if he gargled with sawdust each morning. But that harsh, forward manner was a comfort to Anduin. While most at court bowed and scraped around in the king's presence, Shaw always gave it to him straight. The clouds overhead bunched and threatened to unleash a downpour, but Anduin ignored the coming rain, jumping down from the saddle with an ease of a practiced rider. Reverence seemed agitated, tossing his great white mane and gnashing his teeth. The king made his way around to the horse's head, taking a few slivers of apple from his pocket and offering it to the beast. Ah, his halter had gone crooked. He let the horse lean its warm, soft nose into his shoulder while he fixed the bit and touched his forehead to the spot between Reverence's eyes.
"You know, when I was very young and learning to ride, my father took me to the stables and gave me my first pony, dappled, gentle, 13 hands. I asked my father why horses were measured in hands."
Anduin smiled wanly at the distant memory.
"He only grinned at me and said he didn't know. Then he barked at the groom, asking if he knew. Nobody did. I think the groom probably soiled himself, he was so embarrassed. The poor lad was hardly older than I was. Marvin was his name, I think."
Shaw was still in the saddle, his expression suddenly distant.
"I didn't know him."
But Anduin knew better, knew Shaw was holding something back. He almost certainly had known Marvin, and Marvin had probably died somehow, in one war or another, by an orcish axe or poisoned forsaken blade. Maybe his house had collapsed in the cataclysm and the ground had swallowed him whole. Anduin pushed the bitter thought aside.
"I was shocked. My father, the King of Stormwind, had just admitted his own ignorance in front of a servant. I told him as much. And do you know what he said?"
Shaw shook his head no.
"He said, only the fool thinks himself an expert in everything. The wise man admits his limitations and endeavours to know more."
They were both silent for a moment, listening to the storm roll its way across the Dagger Hills, moving north toward them.
"He wasn't an easy king to serve, but there was satisfaction in the challenge. The same can't be said for all rulers."
At that, Anduin winced.
"Ouch. Oh, there's satisfaction in service to your crown, too. It's just a bit more of a challenge."
Shaw replied with just a hint of a smile, and that was the most the enigmatic spymaster ever gave.
"Case in point, you're avoiding my question."
"No, Shaw, I was answering it."
Anduin held Reverence's reins loosely with his left hand, pointing to the forest with his right. And beyond that, the spires of Stormwind City rising in the misty distance.
"I'm acknowledging my limitations. Today was...
Anduin groped uselessly for the word. Difficult? That didn't cover it. Disheartening? Vexing? Crushing. Taronda and Malfurion had fled to Nordrazil, and all of his missives went unread. A messenger had returned that morning with his letter to them unopened. The man looked shaken, more so when Anduin told him firmly to leave, return to Nordrazil, and try again. No matter how much Anduin attempted to console himself that the rift between humans and night elves could be bridged, its mere existence dismayed him. They ought to be united, solid, though he could not begrudge them their anger. Had Stormwind burned to the ground under his rule, he wasn't sure forgiveness would come easily or ever. A plume of smoke shot up just west of Saldian's farm. An accompanying boom might have been mistaken for thunder were it not for the distinctive sound of splintering wood and a man's scream that followed.
"What was that?" Anduin murmured.
He charged off toward the commotion and the smoke, with Shaw grumbling behind him.
"Caution," the old spy said. "It could be an ambush. These are my people, my lands, and your enemies would use that against you."
But Anduin had heard anguish in the cry from the barn, and he couldn't stand by helplessly while one of his subjects suffered. They reached an open field. The hay gathered and formed into rounds as high as a man, chickens scattered at their approach, and Anduin and Shaw used a gap in a broken fence to enter the field, leaving their horses with their reins looped around the jagged posts.
Could it have been an explosion? I hope nobody is injured.
Anduin quickened his pace, raised voices growing clearer and more numerous as he and Shaw were enveloped by the changing wind and with it, the choking smoke. Anduin batted at it, squinting ahead to see what remained of the barn roof, collapsed in on itself with three men in a heated argument. One fellow, the tallest, was dressed in little but rags, his hair matted and dirty, debris from the explosion hanging in his beard. The other two men wore the simple homespun garb of farmers, patched and pricked with grass, their faces weathered from their labour.
Iago, you miserable half-wit! I said you could shelter in my barn, not use it for your mad experiments!
Closer, and with the smoke dissipating, Anduin could tell that the two farmers were related, one father and one son. The latter, his parent in miniature, with even the same ruddy beard, just with less grey shot through it. The older farmer lunged at Iago, fists balled and at the ready. He stopped at the unmistakable sound of steel being unsheathed. Spinning, he was met not with the blade itself, but simply Matthias Shaw's stony face. The sword never came free of its scabbard. The suggestion that it might was enough to give the farmer pause.
Gentlemen, Anduin said softly, putting up his hands. Is there a problem here?
He's no gentleman, the farmer bellowed. He's a lousy drunk, using my barn to brew his bedeviled moonshine. Look at my roof! How am I to afford the repairs?
It took him a moment to realise whom he was addressing, but he only made the most meagre attempt to bow his head with respect. His son, by contrast, went white as a sheet.
I would have his side of the story too, Anduin replied.
He turned toward Iago, whose only response was to spit loudly and wetly on the ground at the king's feet. Just that much made the man nearly topple over, and his hiccup could have been heard all the way back in Stormwind Keep. The smell of burned wood and burned moonshine wasn't enough to cover up the telltale sour ale stench on his breath.
There,
Iago slurred, pointing at his own drying spittle.
That's all Miss Ida the story is worth. That's all I've left in the world. Me bones, me blood, me bile, nothing. I've nothing.
His eyes flared wide for an instant, his face turning red through the soot coating his face.
Nothing.
He sprang at Anduin clumsily, but even so, Shaw was there to intercept him. Like a flash, the spymaster leaped in front of the king, keeping his weapon half-sheathed, his hand clamping down on the drunkard's shoulder.
I wouldn't, Shaw growled.
Do it! Use that sword of yours,
Iago sputtered. Over Shaw's shoulder, Anduin met the man's tear-swollen, bloodshot eyes. The more he looked at him, the more he seemed somewhat familiar.
I was there. I was there when the Forsaken Queen turned on her own.
Anduin froze, watching as Iago's legs turned liquid beneath him and he slumped down to the ground, the blackened motes on the air settling around him like a blackened snow.
Arathi, I went. I was there. My Wilmer, he was there and he was changed. One of them, all rotten and strange, but still Wilmer, still the best man I ever knew and loved.
Iago's rage took him again, and he snarled, jabbing a finger up at Anduin.
You could have stopped her. You could have saved them.
Shaw carefully lowered Iago's hand.
This is not how you address your king.
My king! My king!
Iago laughed, high-pitched and half-mad.
Not my king! The king of fools may be!
Anduin forced his voice to be steady and moved the spymaster aside.
It's all right, Shaw.
Then he knelt, disguising the quivering he felt in his knees. The shame he still felt about that day, about that failure. He had gone to the Arathi Highlands in good faith to try and mend the rift between those who became forsaken, undead, and the human family members they had left behind. The talks had gone well, until they hadn't. The Queen of the Forsaken, Sylvanas Windrunner, now the most hunted person on Azeroth, had killed her own people, executing any of her kind who chose to reunite and stay with their human loved ones.
"I'm sorry, Yago," Anduin said.
Yago pushed him aside, hard, then managed to climb to his feet and run a few paces out into the field. Swiftly, Shaw turned to apprehend him, but there was no need. Yago fell face down in the dirt, arms splayed out to his sides, and he had managed to fall inches from the pointed leather boot of Alaria Windrunner. Anduin had not heard her approach, and no horse waited beside her, but the ranger had more creative ways of travelling anyway. She nudged the fallen man with her boot and shrugged.
"Still breathing." "That's a relief," the farmer muttered dryly.
Anduin rose and walked resolutely towards Alaria while the farmer detained Shaw, complaining about his ruined roof.
"Just how am I to pay for this? Yago doesn't have a copper to his name."
"Speak with Captain Danuvin," Shaw was telling him coolly. "He can lend you some of the garrison boys to see to the damage."
"Sure," the farmer grunted. "I bet he will."
Anduin stopped a hair's width from Yago's feet, staring at Alaria over the man's toppled body.
"You're early," he said, breathless.
He didn't intend to ignore the issue at hand. Yago mattered, of course. Every subject in his kingdom mattered. But Alaria's appearance had everything to do with Yago's pain. Alaria had been sent on the most urgent of missions, to find Sylvanas Windrunner, but the king had not expected her so soon. Wilmer was just one of Sylvanas's innumerable crimes, and the murderess responsible for his death was to be found and brought to justice. Anduin took Alaria by the arm, leading her away from the field and back towards their restless horses.
"Is early a good sign?"
he pressed. Alaria Windrunner's delicate, pale face was half hidden by her hood, but even so, Anduin read only disappointment in the taut line of her lips. She kept her eyes down on the ground as they walked, her body tellingly rigid.
"No,"
Alaria whispered. Just that one word and her voice cracked with emotion. She looked tired, drawn, dark smudges making her void-touched eyes all the brighter.
"No, my king. I have no good news for you this day."
They had reached the fences. Anduin grasped one of the crossbeams and squeezed the old battered wood creaking. He wanted to break it. He wanted to snap it. A surge of anger made him close his eyes as if he were afraid of what Alaria might see there.
"My sister is not some slovenly boar bumbling across the open plains,"
Alaria continued, drawing back from him and crossing her arms over the green and gold cuirass beneath her cloak.
"She is cunning and using all of her dark power to conceal herself. And you are the finest hunter I know,"
Anduin said through clenched teeth.
"And not one I expected to fail.
You know her best, Alaria.
You were our greatest hope."
Shaw joined them silently, his gaze trained on the void elf. For a moment, none of them spoke, the storm speeding towards the grasslands whipping the winds into a frenzy. A small herd of Gortusks screeched in alarm and galloped away from the fields. A griffin soared overhead, destined for Sentinel Hill. The wood, still creaking in Anduin's grasp, shuddered in his palm, and still he wanted it to snap. It would feel cathartic to break something. They had overcome the Legion, the terror of Sargeras, raining fire and doom upon their world. Yet they had persevered. How many had fallen to that same Legion? How many minds had been corrupted and shredded into ribbons of madness by N'Zoth? Yet even an old god fell to their strength. But one woman evaded justice. It seemed such a small thing to find her, and yet it was proving a costly, perhaps impossible task.
"We will keep trying," Elaria said with mollifying confidence. "She cannot hide forever. Soon enough, she will have to show herself, and when she does, she will have the full might of her enemies bearing down upon her."
Anduin opened his eyes slowly, turning his head toward the blonde elf, and as their eyes met, he felt a jolt, an unpleasant whisper from the dark recesses of his memory. Once, Elaria had suggested to him that Sylvanas face N'Zoth. She and her sister Verisa had been convinced it was the wisest course of action. To Anduin, the request seemed absurd. It still did. Blood was blood, of course, and they had every right to believe in their sister's prowess. Why not let their most pressing threat fight yet another pressing threat? But Anduin had refused. Her power was not in question. But now. He thought perhaps Shaw had said his name, but he felt lost in the dark power of that memory. Why had Elaria asked such a thing of him? How could she be so blind as to extend a chance, any chance, to someone as treacherous as Sylvanas Windrunner? And now she had failed in her one explicit task, to track her sister and help him bring her to justice. Maybe she was hiding something. Maybe the cold glow of her eyes concealed more than just the boundless mysteries of the void. How could he be certain of Elaria's loyalty? Was it a risk? A foolish, reckless risk to keep her at his side? A foolish, reckless risk, just like trusting Sylvanas in the Arathi Highlands when a naive boy king had believed the words of a snake. No. Elaria had proved herself many times, and she spoke true. Sylvanas was no simple quarry. The hunt would continue, and he, as king, would find a way to keep faith in their odds of victory. That was his duty. A man had to know his limits, but he could not reach that limit. Not yet. Too many depended on him now. The fence beam snapped. Just another thing to fix. Another in a long, long line of things to mend. "Come," he said quietly, turning his back on them both. "The gale is nearly upon us. Let us return to Stormwind and decide our next approach. Sylvanas will not rest, and so neither will we."
Chapter 1 Orgrimmar. Much as it surprised him, the dry heat and endless noise of Orgrimmar felt like home. Perhaps it was like returning to a wayward, peculiar family. One thrall had not necessarily chosen, but that he had come to respect. Thrall, son of Durotan, former war chief, had expected to recoil at the familiar scents and mayhem of the Horde city, but he slipped back into its rhythm with surprising ease. In a way, the familiarity of it frightened him. Things had changed, of course. The Horde itself had changed. It had to. No longer could a single war chief rule them all. No. Like a strange family, the Horde had grown, suffered, expanded, retracted, and finally, he thought, They were beginning to find their feet not as different nations united by a single voice, but as a chorus of strong voices raised as one. Wolves grew stronger as a pack in numbers, and there in Grommash Hold, among the Horde Council, he saw many fine wolves at his side.
"Do not fear this," he thought,
gazing around at those assembled.
"You lead no one. You simply sit among equals."
His pride did not chafe at the thought. In fact, he welcomed it. Thrall placed his hands on his knees, leaning forward as two young Tauren braves given report in the centre of the rotunda finished recalling their tale. They had sighted two dark ranger spies on a ridge in the northern barrens, and after alerting a senior patrol in the area, the rangers were tracked and captured. The spies had swallowed some foul concoction and died before they could be questioned, but still, they would no longer be allowed to be the Dark Lady's eyes in Dorotar. A smattering of applause went around the room, and the two braves stood tall, puffing out their furred chests and holding their spears straight. Thrall couldn't stop himself from wondering how long they would live. What cold, bleak place far from here would be their end? What families they would leave behind as they gave themselves over as grist to the mill of war? No. No. They were putting a stop to all of that. That was the purpose of the council, to eschew the bloody whims of one in favour of more tempered policies. And while many still flinched at their mere mention of the armistice, Thrall thought it a reprieve the Horde sorely needed.
"Well done!"
Lorthamar Theron called to the two braves. The leader of the Blood Elves, with his long pale hair, scarred and dead left eye, and painstakingly groomed beard, raised a chalice.
"Bravely done! A toast to these fine soldiers of the Horde! Loctar! Loctar!"
Thrall raised his cup, but his eyes fell on an empty seat beside the crimson-clad leader of the Blood Elves. Other pairs of eyes, and Lorthamar's good one, had wandered to that spot throughout the evening. It seemed almost too ironic. Here they were, a council in response to Sylvanas Windrunner's controversial leadership and self-exile, and nobody sat in her place to speak for the Forsaken. Even the new queen of Zandalar, Talanji, had come from her far-off nation to meet with the council. She sat almost exactly across from Thrall, in the circle of chairs making up the council in the hold, and she had said little so far. Something, he knew, that was uncharacteristic of the brash young queen. Beside her, nearest to the entrance, sat the also newly risen trade prince of the Bildwater cartel, and while Gaslow might have been diminutive in size, he had made his larger-than-life presence known throughout the day's reports, discussions, and disagreements. The goblin had just poured himself more ale when two figures burst through the open archway, startling the Tauren braves and Gaslow, who slopped half his drink down his shirt. He grumbled and swore, his single tuft of brown hair wobbling back and forth as he wiped furiously at the stain. Their conspicuously missing council member had at last appeared. A slight blue-eyed undead woman ran breathlessly into the hold, her gaze flicking in every direction, her posture suggesting she was not at all sorry for their tardiness. Behind her, a ghostly pale woman, also undead, stood with far more poise. They could not have been any more different, the two ladies. One ravaged by her affliction to the bones, the other smooth and unblemished, glowing from within with an arresting light. Lillian Voss, interim leader of the Forsaken, and Kalia Menethil had arrived, stealing the attention of every breathing creature in the hold, and leaving the two reporting braves to shift awkwardly in the sudden silence. Kalia seemed to be watching Lillian's every move, as if she might be tested on it later. Finally, Bane Bloodhoof gestured for them to step away, and the two Tauren shuffled toward him, kneeling on the floor behind their High Chieftain. Nobody spoke. Nobody seemed to know what to say, least of all the new arrivals. Lillian Voss adjusted the worn pack on her shoulder, her boots, greaves, and cloak splattered in fresh mud. To Thrall's right, the white-haired and white-tattooed first arcanist, Thalissra, coughed delicately into her fist.
"I am not their leader."
The silence stretched painfully on. Thrall stood and opened his arms wide to the newcomers, conjuring a warm smile.
"Your absence was keenly felt," Thrall boomed. "The Horde is not the Horde without the Forsaken."
Lillian nodded, biting down so hard on her lower lip that Thrall worried she would break the skin. Her companion, the luminous Kalia Menethil in priestly garb, glided forward, inclining her silver head toward him, graciously said,
"Join us, please."
Thrall returned to his seat and indicated the open set of high-backed chairs reserved for their party.
"You will find Orgrimmar's finest foods and all the wine or mead you can,
we are at your disposal,"
the Volpera Kiro said, paws washing over one another after the mistake. They were new to the Horde, after all. More softly, he added,
"Please take a seat."
The gaff broke the tension, and Gazlo got a good chuckle out of the tawny Volpera's misstep. The undead had no need of food or drink, and Thrall was glad to find their new Forsaken leadership did not take offence. Instead, they were welcomed by the immense and feather-bedecked Bane Bloodhoof and Lorthamar, sitting on either side of the empty chairs.
"May we ask what detained you?"
Lorthamar inquired as the ladies were seated.
"Our people can't stay in Orgrimmar forever," Lillian replied, at last finding her tongue.
Once she had sat down and unburdened herself of her pack, she appeared more at ease. Her blue eyes flashed brighter as she straightened her back and removed her leather cloak.
"It's too hot. We prefer the shadows and the damp. Perhaps in time the ruins of Lordaeron can be reclaimed and our home there restored. Things are a little less heated with the armistice, but that doesn't mean Alliance ships are happy to see our flags at sea."
Across from them, sharpening a knife beside the trade prince, the dark spear troll Rokan hissed and leaped to his feet. His tusks gleamed as readily as his dagger.
"They give you trouble?"
"We took the long way round," Lillian rasped. "Added a few days to our journey."
"Better to be careful in these tense times," Kalia added softly, "lest we cause a diplomatic incident." Then she shrugged, weary, and removed her sun-faded blue shawl, folding it neatly.
"I am sure if we were intercepted, Derek Proudmoore could intervene on our..."
"The Proudmoores can do nothing for us."
Just when Thrall felt the thrum of nerves in the room dissipating, the young Zandalari queen was on her feet, icily rigid. Talanji slashed her hand through the air, her many golden piercings twinkling softly as she did, her tall jewel-encrusted headdress casting a looming shadow that reached across the hold and flickered in the firelight. Leather squeaked and iron jangled as the murmurs and shifting began. Behind him, Thrall heard his page, Zekan, blow out a long breath.
"The Horde could not stop the attack on Zandalar, a failure I took in stride, believing that when we had recovered, we could take the fight to the Alliance, to the Proudmoores."
Talanji continued, her voice shaking with emotion.
"Peace
with the Alliance means peace with the Proudmoors, with Jaina. I was foolish to believe my people would have their revenge.
Thrall squeezed the bridge of his nose, and it had all been going so smoothly. Perhaps he should have expected this. They were all so different, these assembled leaders, with conflicting ideas on what it meant to be part of the Horde, and no doubt their vision of the future varied as well. The tide of uneasy voices in the room began to crest. Before he could offer something mollifying to the new queen, Lillian was quick to respond.
Derek is one of us now. You will have to accept that.
Talanji snarled, taking a single menacing step toward the Forsaken leader.
I have to accept nothing. You need me, and I had thought we had need of the Horde. Now I see you will not help us seek justice for the siege of Zoldazar.
Without blinking, Lillian stood up, poking a bony finger in the troll's direction.
Zandalari justice is not the only justice that matters. The Forsaken have been cast aside, spat on, and ignored for long enough. Derek is Forsaken, and the Forsaken are the Horde.
A smattering of agreeing noises travelled around the hold.
Are the Zandalari not the Horde?
Talanji replied hotly. It was her time to hold court, apparently, and she strode to the centre of the room, raising her voice above the many muted discussions that had broken out.
Where is the Horde response? Where is the support for my people? When will you acknowledge our wounds?
If we act rashly, then we endanger the armistice. The Nightborn Arcanist, Thalysra, interjected wisely in Thrall's opinion. She sat calmly with one calf resting on her knee, her hands propped gracefully on her thigh as she observed Queen Talanji and Lillian Voss inching closer to blows.
Our resources are stretched thin as it is,
Lorthamar put in reasonably.
We must be thoughtful if we are to commit our navy to your struggles. Perhaps diplomacy is the answer here, and a delegation could be dispatched to call Tyrus to... Delegation? Diplomacy?
Rokan thundered, shaking his head.
Pah! My ancestors be weeping to hear this cowardly talk in Gramash Hold.
At that, the Maghar orcs clustered next to the dark spears, grabbed their weapons and slammed the pummels on the ground in agreement. One managed to raise his voice, even above Rokan's protests.
There,
Talanji pointed to Rokan.
At least there is still one among you who has not been left toothless by this talk of peace.
We all have our grievances,
Bane Bloodhoof reminded her.
But those must be weighed against the interests of the Horde now. It is not easy, Your Highness. Nobody thought it would be. In time, we can seek to right the wrongs done to the Zandalari.
In time,
she whispered aghast. It was then that Thrall realized he was one of the few left sitting. The room erupted into splintered arguments. Fragments of those long simmering grievances reaching him as he locked eyes first with Bane Bloodhoof and then Lorthamar. Leader or not, it seemed the unpleasant task of restoring order would fall to him. Bane had tried his best, but he required solidarity. Thrall stood, then Bane, then Lorthamar, finally Thalysra, each of them silent, and it took only a moment for the others to notice. One by one, the voices died down until all gazes turned toward them. Before Thrall could call for quiet, Talanji stormed out of the assembly, her bodyguard scrambling to keep pace, making nervous, half-apologetic bows to Thrall as they fled after her.
Perfect, he said with a sigh. Meeting adjourned. We will eat and drink and come together again. If we can come together,
he added silently. It was a warning wrapped in silk, but it was not misheard. Sheepish eyes slid away from him as he cut a path through the leaders and their entourages, the crowd parting silently for him as he made for the door. He was not yet an old orc, but each one of those steps through the hold intensified the exhaustion settling in his bones. What had he agreed to? He pinched his nose again, warding off the searing headache brewing at the base of his skull. Physical brawls left him feeling less bruised. The scents of prairie grass and churned earth carried on the hot afternoon sun flooded him with memories. He blinked his way into the brightness outside, shielding his eyes, remembering a moment not long ago when he stood with the same smells blowing around him, high above the scooped valley of Molgor, perched on the cliffs of Thunderbluff. Jaina Proudmoore, Talanji's nemesis, had stood beside him, assuring him that a fragile alliance between them was worth the blood and strife it would surely cost.
Horde, alliance, he had said to her. We have come to this crossroad again and again, Jaina. It always falls apart. What's different this time?
Her hand had lain softly on his arm, and perhaps more than her words, that one simple gesture moved him. We are. Thrall had believed her, but now he wasn't so sure, with his head being split in two by the council's argument ringing in his ears. A haze of dust over Orgrimmar dulled the relentless sun. Ceremonial torches outlined a smoky trail out of Grummash Hold, and towards a dozen or so feasting tables laid out beneath the makeshift red tents painted with the Horde emblem. Predictably, a crowd of curious onlookers waited outside the hold, filling the valley with their curious whispers and gasps of interest as the other council members filed out behind him. There was a festive spirit in the air. Drums and flutes, pennants shaped like winged, horned wind riders, flapping at the ends of sticks held by eager toddlers' fists. Parents had pressed their children up close to the perimeter of the tents, and some little ones had been hoisted onto shoulders. Thrall stood for a moment, with the sunshine warming his bare shoulders, and smiled ruefully at one of two young orcs, each balancing on one of their father's shoulders. As he waved to them, Zakhan ambled up to his side. Lorthamar drifted by, with First Arcanist Thalithra at his side, listening, rapt, as she extolled the virtues of the fine nightborn wine she had secured for the feast.
What is it?
Thrall asked. He could always tell when the brave young troll shaman had something on his mind. The boy was good for a lot of things, but hiding his emotions was not one of them.
There's a messenger from the Earthen Ring here, Zakhan told him.
The other council members overtook them, making their slow procession toward the feasting tents. Lorthamar took his time, basking in the adulation and interest of the crowd.
I said it was feast time, he growled.
You'll be wanting to hear this.
Thrall had known during his time as Warchief that what now could in fact become a perpetual state of being. Turning away from the crowd, he found himself standing before a grey-faced old orc, pockmarked and bearded, with a scar slashed through his lips.
Yukar,
Thrall said. This was no mere messenger. He recognised the shaman at once. They had served together against the Legion, and anything that might drive Yukar from his post in the maelstrom was dire indeed.
Thrumkar, old friend, what brings you to Orgrimmar?
They clapped hands on each other's shoulders, and Yukar chewed his cheek for a moment before drawing a deep, sorrowful breath.
The spirits, Thrall. They are in disarray. Where once we communed peacefully with the ancestors, we now find them angry and vengeful. They lash out. They deny us their wisdom. My friend, something is terribly wrong.
Yuka shifted his carved staff to the other hand nervously. It was not like the battle and time-tested seer to fidget so.
When?
Thrall asked in a low voice, keeping the conversation strictly between them. Zekan sensed he was not invited to the discussion and took himself a polite distance away.
I came with all speed, Yuka replied. The journey is unforgiving on my body now, but I knew you would listen to me, old friend.
Of course, you were never one to jostle your bones for less than the end of the world,
Thrall teased, but they only spared the shortest, driest laugh together.
You jest, but I have never seen such unrest in the spirit world before. You know how many long, long winters I have seen.
Thrall nodded, his hand still resting firmly on the shaman's upper arm.
I have heard you, Yuka. The council will know of this, and I will see to it personally that your concerns are not ignored.
That drew a relieved smile across the orc's wrinkled face.
Haste, son of Durotan, haste! The ancestors cry out, and we must listen.
Chapter 2. Nazmir. Apari clasped her hands together under her chin, watching the last drop of life seep out of poor Seshi's eyes. No, not poor Seshi. Foolish Seshi. The old wound in Apari's leg throbbed, but she ignored it. Her work was too important.
You chose death, she told him softly. When ya choose her.
Witch!
His last ragged word echoed for a moment in the damp cave. It sounded as if the lower of death himself had torn the cry from the troll's throat. The troll's blue eyes flashed bright with desperation one last time and then went blank, his stare fixing on a point somewhere over Apari's shoulder. On her other shoulder, a hungry dread tick sat hunched and eager, its sharp little mouth sucking at the air, no doubt tasting death.
Not this one does, Apari warned the tick. One sip of his blood and you be flat as a coin, all your insides on the outside.
Wretchweed, common as clouds in the primal wetlands. Seshi lay dead on a large stone slab, all that remained of a column from the Zul'jan ruins to the east. A harsh, foul smell emanated from the body already, his purplish skin shriveled up and sagging, as if he were a dried fruit. Fluid dribbled steadily from the stone slab, joining the soft drip, drop, drip of water from cracks in the cave's ceiling. The constant drumming of the waterfall concealing the cave's mouth distorted for a moment, and then Apari heard the nearly imperceptible footfalls of her most trusted general.
This is how it will be? Teo asked.
She joined Apari next to the corpse and wrinkled her nose. A huge slice of bone pierced her septum, her elongated tusks capped with sharpened gold points. Mud and black paint made her long ponytail look like a tar spill. Teo had been a loyal friend and lieutenant since Yasmar's attempt at a coup. Her family had been sympathetic to the spy mistress's ideas, and subsequently banished by Talanji, threatened with execution if they returned.
This is how the traitor queen will die?
Wretch weed and river bud root, Apari told her, holding up a small satchel of powder.
my own creation. A purge to remove the rot at the heart of our great land, sister.
Apari knew her weeds and herbs, her poultices and powders. After receiving a grievous injury to her leg, she had tried everything to relieve the pain, the swelling, and then the infected smell. Nothing worked. It seethed and reeked on until at last she had accepted that, like many scars and betrayals in her life, it would simply have to become another reminder of all that she had lost. In the jungle villages of Zuldazar, wretchweed was everywhere, and healers used it as a purge whenever a child swallowed something poisonous. The right quantity helped, but when dried, powdered, and mixed with riverbud root, wretchweed became lethal. And it was not a gentle way to pass on to the other side. Teo nodded.
She deserves to suffer. Where will it be done?
Apari turned and regarded her general. It was a far more pleasant sight than the desiccated mess on the stone slab.
Before the hall of her precious hoard. She has chosen them over her own people. Now let her die among them, she sneered.
Ancestors be willing.
Ancestors be willing,
Teo echoed, making a fist and touching it to her enameled harness. Two leather bandoliers crisscrossed her chest, packed with brightly feathered poison darts.
There is more. The pale rider is here. He arrived with an unliving elf. They be anxious to speak with you.
The body behind her let out a hiss of air, and Apari twisted, watching the muscles in the troll's shoulders and chest contort. Black bile flowed freely from between his cracked lips. She imagined that same thick ooze pouring out from Talanji's mouth, her bright eyes dim and hollow. Wretchweed purged the sickness in one's body, but this went far beyond sickness, far beyond one troll's death. Talanji was a symbol of everything corrupt in the Zandalari Empire, her reign no more than a stain on their ancient and powerful legacy. She only wished she could be there to watch the traitor queen claw at her own throat in fruitless desperation.
Apari?
She nodded once, and Teo returned to the entrance of the cave with its curtain of a waterfall. Dars squirmed on her shoulder, hungry. Outside, beyond the cascade of water and shadows that hid them, a herd of Zorilisks grunted and shrieked at a passing threat.
Go,
Apari said quietly.
Hunt.
The tick fluttered its grey wings and scratched at her shoulder, then glided away toward the water sheeting down from above. Apari watched Dars go, the sun glinting against the waterfall, a kaleidoscope of colours flashing so swiftly it might have been her imagination. But no, the rainbow remained etched on her vision, turning the shadows purple and blue. A good omen. Dars soared like a child's ball toward the sunlight, his soft wings just grazing the top of the man's head. So, they had come. She shivered. Things were in motion now, truly in motion, and Apari felt suddenly alive. It seemed like years, an age, since she had experienced such excitement. Apari folded her hands together, the heavy rings there clacking as she limped towards their guests. The man, dark of hair and red of eye, brushed with annoyance at the tick, then pulled at the collar of his thick black coat. Teo towered a head taller than he, of near equal height to his armoured companion.
Pale rider, Apari called out to him. You are welcome here, but in 2 hours we depart. We do not stay long, and the sun never sets twice on our camps.
A wise precaution.
His bright gaze swept the cave, landing on the grisly sight behind her. He simply smirked.
We have come to discuss
our arrangement? Might we speak elsewhere, or is this what passes for courtesy in your swamp? No, Apari replied. She inclined her head with respect, but did not bow. Apari no longer bowed to anyone. Not courtesy, but a promise. The man arched one black brow, and the elf to his right sighed with impatience. Her pink skin, veined and mottled, was as sickly as the Sky Terror's webbing. She held a strange winged helmet under one arm, and Apari wondered just how she could fight smothered in so much heavy armor. But she did not wonder if the elf was dangerous. The murderous glint in her eye transcended culture and custom. A promise, Apari reiterated, answering the dead man's silent question.
A vow to my mother, who drank the venom of Shadra, and to all of Zandala who deserve better than a crown and gods who care not for them.
She pulled a green stalk of wretchweed from her pocket and held it up, twisting it in the light.
Shadra is gone. Yasma is gone too, but poison lingers. Poison in my heart, she murmured. And soon, poison in the traitor queen's veins.
Zakhan had not avoided the unforgiving boot of war by staying still. No, he had learned to make himself useful, to stay useful, and to know when that usefulness had come to its end. He had not landed on Vorok Sarfang's side on the battlements of Lordaeron by twiddling his thumbs or taking a nap, and so he did not stand still while his commander descended into a quiet, intense exchange with the Earthen Ring Shaman. He casually fell into step behind the tall and well-armed leader of the Darkspear Trolls, Rokan, using his shadow as a concealment of sorts, ignoring the screams and cheers of the crowds as the assembled council members and their assorted bodyguards, advisers, and hangers-on retreated to the tempting shade of the feast tents. Zakhan wasn't foolish enough to think those celebratory cheers were for him. No, he was in a shadow, and was a shadow, first his father's, then Sarfang's, and now Thrall's. And as a shadow, he crept along, looking for something interesting enough to occupy his time.
Keep your hands busy and your mind sharp,
his father, Hekazi, had told him when Zakhan was still knee-high to a raptor.
And you will never want for work, nor amusement.
Work and amusement would have to go hand in hand that day. A drum circle with a trio of wild dancers had been set up outside the tents to welcome the esteemed guests. He watched the goblin, Gazlo, sidle up toward the drums, doing a silly two-step and making the dancers laugh. The music, the steady, infectious rhythm of it, gradually spread to the others approaching the tent. Tent shoulders moving instead to the beat, narrowed eyes widening with appreciation at the talented and scantily dressed dancers. Only Talanji and her Zandalari contingents stood apart. The detached detachment. He wasn't exactly surprised. While the Horde Council had welcomed her and her folk warmly, her response had so far been nothing but chilly. Zakhan had kept a close eye on her, intrigued and admittedly a little besotted with the beautiful queen. She had the most delicate tusks and arresting blue eyes. She also quite clearly had a temper. Talanji paced back and forth on the far southern end of the feast tables, a turquoise-skinned, yellow-haired young troll girl fanning the queen with a massive palm frond. Annoyed with the little puffs of wind, Talanji batted at the girl, shooing her away. Zakhan frowned. Had there not been more bodyguards with Talanji when they arrived? Or had one of her handmaidens gone missing? Orgrimmar was not the most confusing city to navigate in the world, but perhaps one of the Zandalari had gotten lost on their way to the meeting that afternoon. Maybe, he thought.
Maybe. He sidled closer, sensing an opportunity. The Horde needed every advantage it could get, and that meant securing Talanji's allegiance anew. An ally willing to join them in war or peace, one willing to provide troops, one willing to join the council. So far, she didn't seem very impressed.
Might I be of service, Your Majesty?
Zekan gave a low bow and brought out his most dazzling smile. The girl fanning the queen made a tiny sound of alarm. The queen herself stared at him, through him, then rolled her eyes.
And how could you possibly be of service?
Her keen eyes no doubt took in his humble garments and dirt under his fingernails. Meanwhile, she and her servants glittered like firebugs at dusk.
Your entourage be looking a little light. If you need an errand run or a fresh cup of wine.
Talanji tilted her head to the side, her earrings jangling softly as she interrupted him.
You are spying on me now.
Not the response he was hoping for. Zekan backed away, already bracing for the lecture Thrall would give him for bothering the queen. He threw up his arms as if in surrender, a cold shiver overcoming him, like someone had traced the tip of a knife down his spine. He then fell backward, steady one minute and flailing the next, his elbow smashing into something hard and then wet, a goblet. Talanji's missing servant had returned, and Zekan had crashed right into him. The cup and its contents fell to the ground, splashing wine all over Zakan's feet and the hem of Talanji's gown.
Mind yourself!
The servant carrying the tray and goblet shouted, scrambling to scoop up the fallen goblet. He was older than Talanji, the servant, with scars crisscrossing his nose and a visible sheen of sweat over his brow.
Clumsy oaf! That was the queen's wine!
Just a mistake, Talanji said, calmly lifting her skirt to inspect the damage. He meant no harm.
But Zekan stopped listening to the queen, staring at the stain on the fine white silk of her dress. First Arcanis Thalissera's silken voice was suddenly in his head.
I cannot wait for you to sample our arc-fruit sangri, Lorthamar. We have generously arranged enough for all of Orgrimmar to enjoy.
The ugly splotch on the queen's hem was purplish-blue and turning black. What's more, the puddle left behind on the dirt smelt distinctly of death.
Another cup for your majesty. I will return.
The servant was saying, bowing to Talanji as he shuffled away.
No.
Zekan knelt and swept his fingers through the spill on the ground, then sniffed. Whatever it wasn't wine. An herbal tea, maybe? Or something worse?
What will you be serving her?
Wine,
the servant stammered. But the sweat on the troll's brow poured heavy down his temples.
Just wine.
Standing, Zekan had barely enough time to wedge himself between Talanji and the scarred servant, who yanked a dagger from under his tunic and lunged toward the queen. The commotion had aroused the interest of the entire council, and now Zekan felt the feasting tents explode into chaos around him. The drums went abruptly silent, followed by hushed whispers from the crowd outside.
Back! Zekan thundered at Talanji. Behind me!
A throwing axe flew straight over Zakan's shoulder, close enough to give him a haircut. He shook it off, hurling a fork of lightning right after the axe. The bolt slammed the servant into the tent pole before he slumped to the ground. The throwing axe buried in the ground beside him, a narrow miss. Thrall's heavy tread came next, and then his intimidating shadow as he raced by them and toward the assassin. That explained the axe.
Hold him!
Someone was shouting. Protect the queen!
Zekan came to his senses and stumbled after Thrall, who reached the assailant a moment too late. The dagger was still in the troll's hand and swiftly put to use, jammed into his own stomach and yanked upward.
Speak!
Thrall had the troll by his neck, but the dagger had done its gruesome work.
Who sent you? Who sent you?
The old scarred troll had just enough left in him to whisper a final threat.
She will know our bite.
Then his head went loose on his neck, a trickle of blood seeping from between withered lips. No sooner had the troll spoken his last than Talanji was upon them, pushing Thrall and Zakan aside and kneeling in the blood-soaked earth beside the assassin.
He is Zandalari, one of my own. But how?
All of your people must be held and questioned, Thrall replied sternly. There is never just one assassin.
Question your own people,
Talanji fumed, leaping to her feet, her hands and gown covered in blood, covered in poison.
We will return home before more blood can be spilled.
Thrall sighed and shifted, standing in her way.
I assure you.
You can assure me nothing. Not ships, not soldiers. Not my own personal safety.
She straightened her head, and at her height, she could easily look Thrall in the eye. Zekan cowered, the tension around them thicker than tar.
You do not need me here. Zandala, my home, will always need me. So that is where I will be.
All eyes followed the Zandalari queen as she gathered her small entourage and marched out of the tents, head held high and proud. All eyes, Zakhan noted, except for those belonging to Thrall. It had all happened in the space of a blink, the assassin, the axe, the queen's outrage. He couldn't help but fixate on the moment when his arm knocked the cup out of the assassin's hand. He felt certain his feet had been firmly planted on the ground, that something or someone had shoved him back into the Zandalari. The council members came one by one, drawn by the commotion, the dark spear chieftain Rokan appearing at his side, only then sheathing his daggers. Smirking, the taller troll clapped Zakan on the back, and Zakan was just dizzy enough from the chaos to sway a little from the force of it.
You did good, boy. Those be the reflexes of Kimbul.
But I didn't do it.
The lightning he could take credit for, but the cup? The cup. He frowned, gazing around at the faces of relieved council members. Only Thrall, visible at the back of the crowd, shared his concern. His brow furrowed, his eyes dark and distant. Now all the mightiest the Horde had to offer gathered around him, echoing Rokan's sentiments. Already he heard someone say the word, hero, and Zakan shook his head. No, he wasn't a hero at all. Just a boy from the jungles, from a village that would fit inside the gates of Orgrimmar 100 times over. He only wanted to make himself useful, not win some kind of accolade. Zakan found Thrall's face among the throng again, but his expression went unchanged. The single black smudge in the otherwise cloudless sky, the distant warning presaging rain. Only a few would notice it. Only a few would take heed. But when the great leader worried, the wise warrior beneath him worried too. The dark spear chieftain placed a hand on his shoulder. But Zakan didn't smile. He trembled instead. Chapter 3 Dazar'alor. A hot, dry wind reached Talanji from the north as if Vol'dun itself sighed toward her,
She stood atop a great seal and inhaled as the breeze came, hoping to absorb the very essence of her home back into her body. This is where she belonged. The jungle. The vast golden city of her ancestors. Standing there was like standing at the edge of the world. Nothing but verdant possibility and life stretching in every direction. On a clear night such as this one, she could see all the way to the tops of the mountains to the west, even above the Temple of the Prophet, to the peaks draped in emerald velvet. Home. Zeki removed Talanji's heavy ceremonial bracelets and rings one by one, collecting them in a box lined in fabric as soft-looking as those green, green mountains. With each removed piece, Talanji felt lighter, but also strange, vulnerable. For a moment, she tore her eyes away from the jungle and instead watched Zeki work with deft little hands. Those serving the royalty of Zandala were trained to be all but invisible, to move on silent feet, to dress the royal body while barely being perceived. But she perceived the young troll then, her simple plaits of dark blue and sweet young face